what do you say to those who say, the better campaign you run now, between now and Tuesday, the more votes you get, the better it will be for D'Amato?
Well, I say to them that there's nothing arrogant about my candidacy. I have offered myself to the people of New York because I have so much seniority and clout. I'm rated second most effective senator in the Senate by a survey just made the other day. But I felt in a time of crisis like this, it was my duty to offer myself to the people again. They may accept me or reject me. And whether I get 23% or 35% or 6% is entirely up to them. I have no way of directing their votes. And so as it is my duty to do what I'm doing because of what the people have given me, I feel entirely justified in proceeding.
Chi-Chi Williams is somewhere in New York State and has some potential voters with her, I'm told. Chi-Chi, if you hear me, let's hear the questions from wherever you are.
Rosa Del
Field
Mall on Long Island, and I had some questions from Ron Carlo. He's the sales manager. He has a question for Senator Jeb.
Senator Jeb, being that New York City is the biggest city in the world, one big problem that we have is unemployment. And I want to know if you're reelected, where would you go about correcting this problem?
I believe the major burden of unemployment is because we're in a recession, and we can only pull out of that recession by doing an infinitely better job in the productivity and competitiveness of the American business system. I propose, and my side of the aisle certainly backs it, to work out a business tax cut, which will materially improve our productivity, being directed right at us, and enable us to compete with Germany and Japan. And for youth, which is especially heavily impacted with unemployment, about four times, especially minority youth, the unemployment rate for others, special programs are necessary for their training, and one of those programs, which I'm in the way of legislating, is to give them work-study opportunity, keep them in school, but give them a job after school, and therefore keep them on the straight and narrow. And finally, the United States government and many voluntary agencies and the business system have got to train these young people as well. And I will work very hard to effectuate that.
Chi-Chi, do you have someone else with a question?
Yes, nuclear energy is of concern to Beth Rosati. What's your question?
My question, as a young woman on Long Island, I want to know what you'll do to make sure that my children won't grow up exposed to the issue.
That relates to the safety of nuclear power, and we cannot produce nuclear power unless it is really and truly safe. But we cannot reject nuclear power because we're superstitious about it either, because nuclear power is absolutely essential if we're going to free ourselves of the blackmail of these OPEC countries which are bleeding us white.
Senator Javits, I want to thank you for making yourself available to us and to your potential constituents. I turn it now back to Bill.
Still have an eye with us.
Myself, the member of a proud minority, what tremendous gratification there is to oneself and to the community from which one comes in success, as we measure success in this country, financial, in terms of career attainment, and in terms of public service. And Bruce always emphasized, and I know that President Barnes does the same thing, a duality of responsibility as a member of the 100th Black Man. On the one hand, he would have the responsibility of emulation. That is, that by your success, you inspire others. You show it can be done. This, incidentally, is a very interesting point because it obtains through much of life. You know, it's only ordinary mortals who are presidents of the United States. The job is undoable. Or a mayor of New York, and that job is undoable. Or even senior senator from this state, and that job is undoable. But it becomes doable when you realize that others have had it before you and somehow or other, they did successfully work it out and work through it and lead a full and rich life. And so the emulation by others, the kids in high school, and many adults of successes like yourself becomes very important. And secondly, it is a fidelity to leadership. A community like this, as you know as well as I, and I know it well, suffers greatly for lack of leadership. And when I say leadership, I'm talking about trusted leadership. That's what really counts. And that's what you represent. And this organization, in a sense, and a very helpful sense, has been the good housekeeping seal on that. The fact that you belong to this organization has been considered a certification that it's not self-seeking or self-aggrandizement, but that you are really genuinely interested in community improvement, and that you feel you have a responsibility to the community, which can be translated into self-denying action, which you can help the community to take. And leadership also includes the capability to lead. And in that respect, I'm going to tell you a little story about Bruce. When he was first suggested for the president of OPIC, I had very grave worries about it. Bruce and I were friends, and I had been through his own business problems in which he made an unusually towering recovery after great misfortunes with which he had nothing whatever to do, just happenstances, acts of God. So I had great confidence in him as a business executive. But he didn't know beans, I thought, about the overseas private investment and the very complicated deals which the United States, in its own interest, ought to guarantee in order to encourage development in the developing countries. And remember that the OPIC operates at a profit, not at a loss. And it's not grant money, and it's not foreign aid giveaways, but it's a very effective business-aiding organization to accelerate and improve the development of developing countries. But when Bruce went to work on the job, and I was one of his sponsors, and I'm very honored and pleased that I was and had that faith in him, he did one thing which is absolutely extraordinary. Now, he's going to be a little surprised because he hadn't heard me say this, but I want to say it to you and in his presence. He showed an extraordinary sensitivity to the job, and he was able to impress men who knew much more about international finance and international business arrangements than he did with the fact that he was not going to get in their way, but he was going to be the boss. A very, very interesting combination, believe me, and very hard to do, and Bruce did it successfully. That he would be the boss, he'd run it, but he would not get in their way in terms of their expertise or way they really knew what needed to be done, and that he had that unique sensitivity which would give them their head when they ought to have it and not restrain them, and at the same time run the show in the way that he thought it ought to be run. Bruce, I think it's one of the thundering successes in Washington that you have made through that combination, and I congratulate you. Now, if I don't talk about myself and blow my own horn, the boss of all candidates will fire me. So at some point here, I have to tell you about this campaign. Let me just say this in a word, and then I'll go on to develop one or two theses. I will make one private and one public of the theses I'll develop with you. But just let me say about the campaign, so you have it clearly. I have a lot of assets for the people of New York. 24 years of seniority, longer than any senator in the history of this state, I have served in the Senate of the United States. You may have seen a recent poll only yesterday in which I was rated the second most effective senator in the Senate after, indeed I'm honored to be after, Howard Baker, the minority leader. And I've gotten a lot of standing with my colleagues because I've been able to lead them in the solution of many dilemmas or in building bridges where bridges needed to be built in order to reconcile highly conflicting points of view. And much legislation on the books is attributable to that ability. And lastly, in this particular season, what is the most needed in foreign policy is a cool head and a lot of understanding of given problems in given parts of the world. For example, to give you one of the things in which we are woefully deficient in this country, and it showed up strikingly in the debate over the SALT II treaty, was the fact that we find it very hard to look at a situation from the other fellow's point of view. And any lawyer here in the House knows that that's the way to be a good lawyer. You have to look at it from the other fellow's point of view. Now, the Soviet Union has a paranoia about security. And who can blame them? 20 million killed in World War II, and their nation invaded after World War I in order to throttle what they considered to be a legitimate and necessary revolution. And for a long time, the world discouraging them and against them. And so they have a paranoia about security issues. We have to recognize that and be sensitive to it and patient with it. That doesn't mean we have to throw in with it. But we have to understand that for everything that we expect them to agree to, we also have to give something. And so those who testified, for example, against the SALT II treaty, which seeks to put a cap on the arms race, and that cap is very essential, believe me, or it could really go haywire. Instead of realizing, therefore, by those who testified against the treaty, that for everything we wanted to get, we had to give something. None of them, not the best witnesses, the highest military and naval people, could answer the simple question, if the Soviet Union is asked to give up, let's say, the backfire bomber, what are we ready to throw in that's in the SALT II treaty in order to compensate for that? And the answer always was, well, the treaty is so unfair to us that they ought to, or that they will, or that they're sure to make this concession. That's very, very primitive thinking, and it's not going to happen. So in this particular field, as I started to say, a great sensitivity and a great understanding of what takes place abroad is essential. Because throwing your weight around is very easy, but it's also the point of no return. And one great aphorism, which every person experienced in peace and war will tell you, and that is that great powers can't bluff. There's no such thing. You got to be ready to back up everything you say, or you better not say it. And in our problems at home, a great understanding and sensitivity to the American business system is very much required. For example, one of the stickiest problems that we face, and it's not going to be cured by cutting the budget, can't cut it that much, and it's not even going to be cured by a balanced budget, is the fact that we are not competitive as we stand today, and that we're being skinned alive, not only abroad but at home, by people who are more competitive than we, notably the Germans and the Japanese, but others as well. And the way to get competitive is to revert to the standards of productivity and the standards of research and development and technology for which we've always been noted and which made our country strong. And in the last decade, we have dropped down very seriously in that regard. Now, people like myself believe that a tax cut is essential for that purpose. My guess is that that tax cut, together with a certain personal tax cut to sweeten it up and to take care of the problem of increased taxes and Social Security, and the what's called a bracket creep, that is inflation, earns us more dollars and we get into higher brackets, even though our standard of living is not changed, indeed may be reduced. That'll be around a $32 billion tax reduction. And I believe we have the spark, our renaissance in productivity with that. And I'd like to see not less than half of it devoted to business, and the other half devoted for the individual purposes which I described. But that is far from enough. Secondly, we have to revive the research and development of this country, which has fallen down very sharply. And there, too, some tax incentives are going to be required. And lastly, we do need a much better relationship between management and labor. That doesn't necessarily mean organized labor, but it does mean an effort to establish a greater interest in the quality of working life and in the welfare of the worker on the job. He doesn't need any welfare. He gets paid, and well paid. But many are very bored with their jobs because we have not adopted new techniques for labor management relations. Now, this is not a fanciful idea off the top of my head, because we have now three cities in this state where I have been able, with the cooperation of the local authorities, to see such groups organized. Those cities are Jamestown, Elmira, and Buffalo. And the economic climate in all three places has been very materially improved. What these labor management committees do, and by the way, they're now authorized by law, of which I'm the author, and I'm very proud to be, what they do is to deal with problems outside the collective bargaining process. Among those problems are absenteeism, alcoholism, drug addiction, recreation, and the general quality of working life. And they are also beginning to consider what's to be done about productivity in seeing that the worker has a fair share of the action. Now, that doesn't mean that the same plan needs to be considered in every place, but it does put on the table for consideration, instead of collective bargaining, outside the collective bargaining process, a fair consideration of what productivity will mean, an increase in productivity, will mean to the individual worker. And lastly, business has to undertake some of the tasks for which we've considered government to be the only source. And we must make it worthwhile. For example, many women would work and not be on welfare, AFDC or other types of welfare, if they had some place to deal with their children. And in the absence of that, they can't work. Now, government daycare slots and even voluntary organization daycare slots supply about one-tenth of the need. The other nine-tenths is not dealt with, and hence, there are, I think, 11 million women on AFDC, maybe 13. The figure is 11 or 13, but it's very high. I believe that we ought to give an investment tax credit to American business for installing daycare centers in their plants, offices, and factories. It's done abroad, and there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't adopt the same idea. And if we did, I think it would tend to tremendously transform the American society. And lastly, youth. Who knows better than we here what a grave problem there is in youth unemployment. And in this area, where I believe in many parts of it, youth unemployment can run as high as 60%, though the average for minority youth is about 37%. Even that is horrendous. Now, one thing I have already done, but much more is to be done, and that is to have a law, which we have, which gives a rebate on taxes of 6 months' salary for a poor youth, which is taken on as a new effort by an employer. I would like to see added to that also a waiver of the first 6 months of Social Security tax, both for the employer and the employee, which I think would be very helpful. But beyond those measures, youth also needs training very urgently, because most of the problem is attributable to the fact that these youths are not only unskilled, but they don't even know how to begin to get up in the morning when they hear the alarm bell, pull on their pants and go to the bus and get to work on time. And so, in my judgment, we need the cooperation of American business to undertake this on a shared basis as a responsibility. There are 4 million youths in this age slot who need to be dealt with. I don't think it would be taxing American business at all if we could divide up the responsibility for 1 million to 1.5 million of such youth so that enterprises in different parts of the country took them on in an orderly way for training and then for jobs after they had been trained. Some would fall by the wayside, but I don't think that would be nearly as great as the problem we face with them where they are. And secondly, we have a program, but it's not adequately financed, which Humphrey and I sponsor, which keeps youths in high school and gives them work study at the high school level. That is, they get a job which is partly financed by government in private enterprise, and that represents what we do with young people in college who have work study, except that in this case, we keep them from dropping out of high school, which otherwise they would do. Also, we have a massive youth bill, which is wending its way through the Congress. I'm confident it will pass both the House and Senate. Which ties the private enterprise into this whole system that I have described through private industry councils, that is the kind of labor management committee which I described a little while ago for other purposes, which will be applied to youth employment. Now, those are some of the measures with which I am myself concerned and which I believe are auspicious in these fields. I must say that I deprecate the idea, that, which many preach, that if you eliminate the government deficit and balance the budget, that's going to solve everything. It won't. Government doesn't make, government takes. And government only takes a piece of what's made. And so first we have to make before we can take. And that's why I say what I do about productivity and business enterprise. Before I sit down, I'd like to now deal with just one other subject, and then perhaps we can have a few minutes for questions, Mr. President. And that is your civic and public responsibility. And on the way up here in the car, I asked my staff, what did they think was one of the very pressing problems? We know, of course, about housing, and we know about crime and crime in the streets. And one of them suggested health because of the furor about closing hospitals in this particular community. What is happening is, of course, you know, is the doctors and other medical personnel tend to move out of these areas, and hence they become very deeply underserved in terms of reputable practice of medicine. And you either develop Medicaid mills, which are a very grave problem, or the inadequacy of medical facilities completely. Now, there are a number of ways in which to deal with this problem. One of those, which we already have in law, I happen to be the author of it, which is still underfinanced, but is on the books, so it's usable. And by the way, the Harlem Hospital Center has benefited from that particular program right up here already. One of them calls for grants to hospitals to establish primary care centers where their emergency rooms are now overrun with regular patients, many of whom are undocumented aliens or unable to pay and don't have anything, Medicaid or insurance or anything at all, and yet whom they have to treat, so that the capability for establishing really what comes down to primary care clinics becomes a very useful and important technique. And they may be established either on the hospital premises themselves or in other quarters, but under the aegis of the hospital. The other aspect is the ability to make physical improvements to hospitals in order to permit them to meet life safety codes and accreditation standards. Many hospitals simply don't have the resources to do that. Now, there are also very deep problems which deal with really financially distressed hospitals because of the vast numbers of people they must treat that have no way of paying for the treatment. And also ambulatory services of that character, which calls for the expansion of healthcare centers, et cetera, which also falls in the line of trying to work out these problems. And lastly, of course, there's no doubt about the fact that we need a national health plan. I have worked hard for such a plan. I will continue to. My ideas, though I am on Ted Kennedy's bill because I'm so anxious to forward the ultimate result, but my own ideas are a little different from Ted's. For one, I don't believe that we have to cover everybody. I believe that we have to phase in to a national health plan by groups. Now, we've already got the Medicare, which phases in the elderly. We should have kitty care, that's the people who have the least illness, which will phase in mothers and infants. Secondly, we should not try to cover workers who are covered by plans in their businesses, except that we should see that those plans meet the same minimum, at the least, that we establish in the National Health Plan. Now, that will take millions out of the system, but it will also relieve the system of very heavy costs and very heavy administrative problems. I mention health because I would strongly commend to you, Mr. President, an interest by the 100 black men in that particular field. There are many ways of recourse. For example, we were threatened with a big closing in Brooklyn, of the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. And we managed to get them a commitment for a period of years in which they could try to rehabilitate themselves through the use of a demonstration program of the type that I'm discussing from the federal government. There's a lot of money around for hospitals, but it needs to be tapped by people like yourselves. And I would strongly urge you, because of these new handles in the health field, and because it is such a grave problem, give you another example. We now have the power to assign a public health doctors in areas which are underserved medically. Now again, there are too few, and the money is too slim, but it just indicates that there are channels through which something helpful can be done. So, gentlemen, I would end as follows. I'm sorry that I've taken a little longer than I had planned, but I would end as follows. Your leadership is indispensable. There is much resource which can utilize your leadership. And the great thing about this organization is that it inculcates the sense of responsibility and the morale which considers leadership a privilege instead of a burden. And I can only hope for the 100 black men that it may ever be so. Thank you, sir.
If we can very quickly have a couple of questions for the senator, the time permits just that limited number. Yes, sir.
Good question. I'm happy to answer it. I would say no, and for this reason. No one can predict the result of an election, not the poll or anything else. And my only reason for running, which I declared very early in the game, and to which I've adhered constantly, my only reason for running was that having amassed so much seniority and other authority and power, which could be helpful to the people of my state, and having them face, as they do now, a crisis, which they do at home and abroad, I didn't feel that in all conscience I could turn my back on my duty. And so I've offered myself. Now the polls say, and you will see one tomorrow morning, that Ms. Holzman has 29%, and I have 23%, and Mr. D'Amato has 36%. And I say to the people of my state, I have offered myself to you. That was my duty. I assure you, I won't resent anything about anybody if I'm not elected and if you don't vote for me. But I'm not arrogant enough to try to tell you how you must vote. Take your choice. Whatever you think you should do, you will do. For example, the Daily News endorsed me. And they said, maybe he doesn't have much of a chance to win, but he's the best man, so we endorse him. And that's the best I can tell you. I assure you that if I get 6% instead of 23%, I won't be mad at anybody. And that if I get the majority or the plurality, I'll be delighted.